This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about climate voters and how issues around climate change and the environment might have an impact on the upcoming election. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. We are live, so you can also leave us a voicemail as well. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we will do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that phone number for a voicemail is 866-476-3881, or you can download our new app, All In Vox Pop, wherever you get apps, and send us a high-quality voice message that way. We're joined now by four guests. Jesse Carbonda is Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Jesse, welcome.
Glad to be with you, Matt. Thank you.
Denise Abdul-Rahman is the Environmental Climate Justice Chair for the State Indiana State Conference of the NAACP. Denise, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Nathaniel Stinnett is Executive Director and Founder of the Environmental Voter Project. Nathaniel, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Matt.
And Shannon Anderson is Assistant Director of Earth Charter Indiana. Shannon, welcome.
Thrilled to be here.
Jesse, we'll start with you. How much of a role do climate and environmental issues seem to have right now for the upcoming elections here, specifically when we look at Indiana?
Well, Matt, what's been striking is that there was a poll done by the Morrison Center, a university-administered poll, and it turns out that the environment is ranked as one of the top four issues of concern among Hoosiers, right behind education, healthcare, and jobs. And even in the case of climate change, you find that three in four voters believe it's temperatures are rising, and of those, 80% believe some action needs to be taken to address it.
I guess when we look at specific issues like that, I mean, are there ones that are more prevalent or maybe one at the top that might have the most political impact right now?
Well, I think that the issue that has the greatest bipartisan support is around water. And you see that in terms of the legislation, Matt, that has been passed in the Indiana General Assembly in the last couple of years. And of course, you think about all the different repercussions of it, that you think about it from the dimension of drinking water quality, that Hoosiers, whatever their political convictions, want to see that they are able to drink safe water. And you also think about it from the dimension that mayors and county commissioners really want to see their communities thrive. And they recognize that clean river fronts are a critical element to revitalization.
And issues around water in other states, I would imagine, especially out west, look a lot different from Indiana. Out there, they're dealing with issues of water scarcity. It sounds like what we're concerned about here is water quality. Is there any overlap with other issues that we might see elsewhere? Jesse?
Matt, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that, the dominant issue, I think, in Indiana is definitely around water quality. You think about it, it's the issue that I think has been underaddressed from a legislative perspective. You think about it from the vantage point that you've got all these different risks to, say, rural groundwater, whether that is because of the fact that we have the largest number of coal ash dumps in the country, we have factory farms in every region of our state that are unlined, and therefore could leak into our groundwater. You think about all the nitrates and phosphates that could also contaminate drinking water. And if you look at it from an urban lens, you think about the fact that we've got brownfields in many of our urban centers, which leads to situations of potential contamination of groundwater. So I think that the emphasis ought to be, and I think it's reflected in the polling as well, around water quality as opposed to what you see out west, which is water quantity.
Denise, can you tell us about the Environmental Climate Justice Program in the NAACP and what you do there?
Sure. Our program, which I serve also the Midwest and the Plain States for our national office, but both roles are very similar. We advocate for energy efficiency and clean energy, The reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, particularly harmful emissions or the co-pollutants, and our community's livability and resilience and resistance to any harmful impacts.
How would you characterize the current state of climate and environmental issues for communities in Indiana? How much of an impact are they having?
So we see environment and climate as a continuum, and all of it is circled around inequities, racial injustice. Because when you look at the whole system, you know, the very same communities that are hosting pollutants, whether it's transportation system where Black and brown and low-income communities live near highways with diesel fuel emissions, or whether it's the fossil fuel plant that is emitting carbon or greenhouse gas emissions and other pollutants with that system, whether it's the essential workers that are driving those buses or riding those buses. And in addition, all of the systems, water, air, land, living in food apartheid communities, in dire need of resiliency, adaptation, mitigation. So all of those are important to our advocacy on behalf of our communities. And they are the most vulnerable to the impacts of climate and environmental injustice.
Nathaniel, your group looks at national trends in voters and likely voters. What trends have you seen in the last few years? What stands out the most?
Well, what by far and away stands out the most is that we've seen a consistently rising number of climate-first voters in the United States, by which I mean people who care so deeply about climate or other environmental issues that it's their number one priority over all others. And so for some context, if you go back 4 years ago to 2016, only 2% of likely voters listed climate or the environment as their top priority. In the 2018 midterms, so 2 years later, 7% did. Fast forward again to this year, there was just an NPR Marist poll that came out showing that 12% of likely voters now list climate or the environment as their top priority. So we've gone from 2% to 12%. In just 4 years. And to give you an idea of what the raw numbers are there, Matt, if, as many pundits predict, we see 150 million Americans vote this fall, well, 12% of 150 million would equal 18 million climate-first voters, which is more than triple the number of NRA members. I mean, that's a really powerful constituency that has almost come out of nowhere in the last 4 years.
Are there certain demographics that make up perhaps the majority or a larger chunk of that 12%?
Yes, absolutely. Black and Latino Americans are more likely to care deeply about climate and environmental issues than white Americans are. People who make less than $50,000 a year are also overrepresented. And young people are more likely to care deeply about climate or the environment than old people are. So this doesn't necessarily align with a lot of the stereotypes that I think many people have of environmentalists as, you know, yuppies in fleeces driving around their Priuses or wearing Birkenstocks. Like, it's not, I don't know if it was ever actually like that, but it certainly isn't like that now.
To go from the low single digits to 12% in 4 years, that's a huge jump. Why do you think there's been this growing priority for these issues among voters?
Well, it's really hard to know for sure. But what we do know is that a little bit of two things is happening. I'm sorry, I should say a little bit of three things. First, people's behavior is changing, by which I mean, there have always been a lot of people who care deeply about climate or the environment. They just haven't always voted. And now they're getting politicized and showing up in these elections and voting. So one thing doesn't have to do with changing minds. It has to do with changing behavior. The second thing Yes, a lot of people who 4 years ago might not have cared as much about climate or the environment are starting to. And if you look at a lot of research done by Pew and Yale Program on Climate Change Communications, it's very, very clear that more and more people are caring deeply about these issues. And then the third thing, well, why are more and more people caring deeply about these issues? Well, part of it gets to what Denise was talking about. People are more and more aware of the disparate impacts that certain communities are feeling, not just from the climate crisis, but from toxic air and toxic water, and they're living it every day. And then even people who aren't on those frontline communities, I mean, you can't turn on your TV anymore without seeing a climate supercharged hurricane or an 8 month long wildfire season. I mean, it's just, it's gone from being rare to see climate discussed in the news to becoming almost impossible to ignore. It's being pushed into our faces.
Shannon, I want to make sure I get to you before the end of this segment. We've got about a minute left. In that minute, can you tell us what Earth Charter Indiana does?
Sure. Earth Charter Indiana is a statewide climate justice organization, and we focus mainly on youth climate advocacy and also local intergenerational climate advocacy. We work a lot with cities, towns, and mayors, and we work a lot with young people who are increasingly the force behind this new climate movement. And we bring those things together in as many ways as possible.
I've seen that term, intergenerational climate advocacy, before. What do you mean by that in about 30 seconds?
Sure. We have a lot of people who've been part of this climate movement most of their adult lives, and they are your traditional environmentalists. But more and more, we're seeing younger climate activists who are charged because of the severity of this crisis and the kind of looming threats to their own future and their own security. And so they're working together in cool new ways to bring about change in their own communities.
We'll be back with our guests after a quick break. We're talking today with a live panel of experts and advocates about the impact climate issues might have in the upcoming November election. And if you have questions or comments for the show, we would love to hear from you. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail. Call 866-476-3881, 866-476-3881, and we'll get your message in front of our panel. Or you can send us a high-quality voice message with our new app, All In Vox Pop. Get it wherever you find apps. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're talking today about climate issues, the growing number of voters who prioritize those issues, and the effect it could have on the upcoming election. And we would love your input. We're welcoming questions and comments on the topic on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can send us a voicemail at 866-476-3881, 866-476-3881, or a high-quality audio message with our All In Vox Pop app. Get it wherever you find apps. And let's see, we'll start this segment off with Jesse. We'll come back to you. So we heard Nathaniel in the last segment about some of the national trends in recent years. He gave us the figure 12% of voters or likely voters coming up this year will put climate at the top of the list, which is huge compared to the 2016 numbers. But what about Indiana? When we look specifically at our state, have sentiments changed among the population here, especially with likely voters?
I think so. I mean, I wish we had something as concrete as Nathaniel had pointed out to us, but I would say that the basis for believing that there will be an increasing number of people who identify as climate voters, I think can be shown in a couple of different ways. One is that we are just simply seeing more extreme weather in Indiana. We see that in the fact that all 92 counties in Indiana were under a natural disaster declaration in 2012 because of widespread drought. And just 2 years ago, we had some of the worst flooding in Indiana in 50 years. And I think that another indication of it is the fact that candidates for office are being much more proactive. Certain elements of the folks who are running for office are making climate change a priority. In fact, there's one candidate I'm thinking of in Northeast Indiana who has made it her top issue. So that, I think, indicates that there is a broader sentiment among the general public for taking real meaningful climate action.
Well, and not to mention, and also not to get into, I guess, specific candidates, but when we look at our junior senator, Mike Braun, who was supported by a number of conservative Republicans, he has brought climate issues to, with respect to Indiana and the nation, to Washington. Have you looked closely at what he has done?
Well, we're happy that he has spoken up for kind of facilitating more carbon sequestration in agriculture. And I think that's important from a policy perspective, because farmers do have a role to play in tackling climate change by basically making their farm fields into these massive carbon sequestration areas where they're growing deep-rooted plants that can store lots and lots of carbon, and plant trees that, of course, can do the same. But what we hope to see among the congressional delegation overall is the commitment to something like a carbon tax that would dramatically accelerate the transition that we're seeing in this country, Matt, from coal and gas towards renewables and utility scale storage. We really urgently need to accelerate that transition, and something like the H.R. 763, the Innovation Act, which groups like Citizens Climate Lobby have been champions of, really needs to become law. And there are Republicans who back this and see this as something that's the most soundest public policy. That and that's really because bipartisan economists see that as kind of the fastest way to decarbonize the country.
Denise, Jesse just kind of touched on this with respect to carbon sequestration, but let's expand on the economic opportunities that might overlap with some of the efforts around these issues. Can you talk a little bit about that and how, I guess, climate-friendly policy can also mean opportunity for making money, I guess?
Certainly, we're all for the green economy. However, we don't advocate for propping false solutions or the root causes to polluting systems. So we're in opposition to technological, geotechnological fixes such as carbon capture, sequester, because that allows for the polluting system to continue to pollute and then put it into the ground. And then what's going to happen, you know, with the surface, you know, earthquakes and things of that nature that have happened even in Terre Haute, Indiana. And certainly not selling and buying of air. Speaking with a lot of indigenous people, you know, the BIPOC communities are opposed to you know, they can't put their placenta by a tree anymore because it's not quite the same, because the air and the building of trees now have a price tag to them to buy and to sell. But from the green economy standpoint, we define clean energy as geothermal, solar, and wind. And we certainly want to see particularly a black to green pipeline. In fact, we have recently launched a Power Up program in Evansville. We're doing another one with Hammond. We've connected with an energy efficiency company, and we're seeing a lot of synergy. And we've even connected with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers that are building a lot of utility scale solar. And we see opportunity for our BIPOC communities to be able to get jobs. And lastly, I'll just say, you know, we have data from Blacks in Energy that says that African Americans pay $41 billion to the energy sector, yet only hold 1% of the energy jobs. So when we talk about a just transition, we're also talking about just transition, not only for coal workers or fossil fuel workers, but we're also talking about the communities that are in proximity and also those of our community that have been massively incarcerated, impacted by police brutality, and are in need of a just transition from the time of our enslavement to the Jim Crow to, you know, the mass incarceration to now. So, yeah, thank you.
Jesse, I would like to follow up on something that Denise just touched on, and that's the issue of carbon credits. And of course, we did a great show a little under a month ago with Senator Stoops, who is, of course, putting forth a bill to be considered next year for the 2021 session on carbon sequestration in Indiana. And of course, the argument comes up when you're talking about this that purchasing carbon credits for companies to go carbon neutral or carbon negative, I heard it a little bit from Denise there. It's almost like it gives companies an excuse to pollute because they're offsetting it elsewhere. But the communities in which they're polluting, it's not offsetting directly there, and you're still getting air quality issues there. Any response to that sort of an argument?
Oh, it's a very valid one. And I guess from our vantage point, I think we need to make progress on both fronts. Of course, you know, we have an environmental justice initiative at the Hoosier Environmental Council. And, you know, one element of that is very much focused on, for example, preserving trees in our urban communities, given that they can protect these communities from stormwater, rising problems with stormwater, that they can shade communities and help to absorb heat and pollution and so forth. But to get to your question, Matt, I mean, I think that we have to find, we're going to be hitting upon here in Indiana successive budget cycles where there's going to potentially be less money spent for protecting endangered open spaces in Indiana. And for perspective, Indiana only has about 4 or 5% of its land that's publicly owned. In Michigan, it's more than a quarter of the state that has open space. And yet we have seen a reduction in state funding for open spaces by 90% since its peak. And that's why it's important to have kind of carbon credit programs as another means of deriving income that can help to protect some of that open space. But I think when we hold companies accountable for the sustainability plans, we need to press upon them to make significant investments in renewable energy so that you can have meaningful offsets in air pollution in these urban communities where the power plants are disproportionately located, and in poor rural areas where they're also disproportionately located, as well as at the same time facilitate these companies helping to accelerate investment in open spaces.
We're talking today on issues around climate change and the environment and how they might have an impact on the upcoming election. We have with us Jesse Carbondo, who you just heard, Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, Denise Abdul-Rahman, Environmental Climate Justice Chair for the Indiana State Conference of the NAACP, who you heard before, Jesse. We also have with us Nathaniel Stinnett, Executive Director and Founder of the Environmental Voter Project, and Shannon Anderson, Assistant Director of Earth Charter Indiana. Nathaniel Stinnett, what's it been like watching the two major political parties react to this increased priority for climate issues from voters? Have they reacted as much or as quickly as you expected, looking at the numbers?
Yeah, they have. Have they reacted as much as I'd like? No. But we are seeing a very clear, and in retrospect, pretty obvious dynamic take place, which is politicians are going where the voters are. Like, politicians are in the business of winning elections. And as you get dramatically more voters caring deeply about climate or the environment, surprise, surprise, you get many more politicians talking about it. And a few examples, again, we can see the number of politicians leading on climate or the environment growing over the last 4 years, pretty much at the same pace as the number of climate voters have grown. So a perfect example is coming out of the 2018 midterms, we saw a significant growth in the amount of power that groups like the Sunrise Movement had. And then heading into 2019 and early 2020 in the Democratic presidential primaries, you didn't just have multiple candidates spending a lot of time and energy talking about climate or the environment. You even had some making it the sole focus of their presidential campaigns. People like Jay Inslee and Tom Steyer, and to a lesser extent, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Michael Bloomberg. I mean, that would have been completely unthinkable back in 2015 and 2016. And finally, I think a really, really important thing to note is after Joe Biden won the Democratic presidential nomination, he did something that you almost never see in modern presidential politics. And that is, instead of tacking to the center, which is normally what nominees do, he tacked to the left on climate and the environment. And again, I think it's pretty obvious what's going on here. There are no dummies on his campaign. They're going where the votes are. They think that it is politically astute, even after winning the Democratic nomination, to tack to the left on these issues, because that's where all the votes are.
There have been questions in both recent debates, the presidential and vice presidential debates, about climate. I'm curious what you thought of those specific questions that were asked in those debates and also the way they were answered.
Yeah, well, I'm never a fan of the do you believe in climate change question.
Right.
We don't have enough time to go through all the things that are wrong with framing that question in that way. You wouldn't ask, do you believe in medicine? Do you believe in gravity and things like that? But I am happy that they're being brought up, because politics is a marketplace like a lot of things are a marketplace. And the media and debate moderators are not going to pay attention and not going to spend their precious time talking about issues that viewers and voters don't care about. So although I've got plenty of quibbles with how some of these questions are being framed and how they're being asked, I love the fact that there is so much pressure on the media, on debate moderators, and on politicians to talk about this issue, that they're at least talking about it. They might not be doing it the way I want them to, but thank God we're not back in 2016 where there wasn't even a single question asked about climate in any of the debates.
Shannon, can you talk about how climate and environmental issues relate to other problems? How important is it for people to talk about those connections?
Sure. I mean, the good news about climate action is that when you start to face and try to mitigate climate change, there are so many social co-benefits. And you can say the opposite as well. When we lift people out of poverty and we address, like, you know, inequality, we're also in some ways fighting climate change. So that's the good news about this movement, is that so many of the things that we're working on as climate advocates also benefit society in so many other ways. We touched upon some of them earlier, like water and air quality. The shift away from fossil fuels to renewable energy, it's not only cheaper, it's also safer and it's more reliable. So communities that are starting to experience those benefits here in Indiana, you know, will be seeing cleaner air and cleaner water for generations to come. And I think that's a really wonderful thing to see.
Do you have any other examples of how things can be interconnected and can benefit in multiple ways or affect in multiple ways?
Sure. I think one of the things that rises to the surface of my work a lot is because we work with young climate advocates, they're not just learning about climate science, they're learning about advocacy and they're learning about civics and engagement. And so that's really exciting for us to watch young people engaging with the political process, meeting with not just their senators, but also city councilors and county commissioners. We have people in Northwest Indiana who have kind of formed a regional resilience group, the Northwest Indiana Regional Resilience organization, that are students and lifelong environmentalists who are meeting with their regional a planning committee to discuss a greenhouse gas inventory. And that gets kids interested in not just science, but also public policy in, I think, a new and different way.
Shannon, when you work with young people, and it sounds like you work with them a lot, do you ever get any interesting questions? Or adjacent to that, how much interest do you see in them on issues that affect the climate and the environment versus what you might hear from older folks?
Absolutely. I mean, I think Nathaniel touched on this earlier, that young people, and especially young voters, are overwhelmingly passionate about climate action. I think around 80% of voters, 18 to 29, now say that climate change is an existential threat to humanity. I mean, that's mind-blowing to me. And we work with young people that see this as a very, very scary issue, but they are the most undaunted people. A story I like to tell is that I was, you know, presenting in a classroom, which we used to do a lot, not so much this year, but we still meet kids online a lot. And, you know, I had gone through some of the climate impacts that we would be facing here in the Midwest, as well as around the world. And a fourth grader asked me, well, if this is so serious, why aren't the adults doing anything about it? And I really didn't have a ready answer to that question, other than to say, well, status quo and money. And young people are not accepting that answer anymore. I think we've seen that with the rise of the Sunrise Movement as well. They are demanding better from their politicians, and I think their politicians are starting to listen.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with experts and advocates about the role climate issues have in the November election, and we welcome your questions and comments. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We are back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on climate voters, people who prioritize issues around climate change when they fill out their ballot. We would love your questions and comments in this final segment. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or feel free to leave us a short voicemail at 866-476-3881, 866-476-3881, or with our new All In Vox Pop app, which you can get wherever you get apps for free, All In Vox Pop. We have with us Jesse Carbonda, Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, and three other guests who I'll get to in a moment. Jesse, we're going to start with you in this segment. You mentioned earlier about a state lawmaker, I believe, who you said made climate the central issue of their campaign. Have we seen lawmakers at the state level take notice of the fact that climate issues are a growing priority? And have you seen it have an impact at the statehouse?
You know, that's a good question, Matt. I mean, one, the most direct way of answering that question is the fact that this last legislative session, the 2020 session, for the first time ever, there was a proposal that got a committee hearing to establish a climate task force. Another indication of kind of things changing at the State House is Youth Climate Action Day, which Shannon can certainly speak to as someone who is instrumental in making that happen. And then you're having bipartisan lawmakers not necessarily talk about climate change per se, but talk about climate solutions, either generally implicitly, because there is this fear among particularly conservative lawmakers that talking about it will stigmatize them. But, you know, from our vantage point, the key issue is the outcome. Are we accelerating the decarbonization of Indiana? However it's done, you know, as long as it's equitable and, you know, it's affordable, we're happy with. And the fact that we're seeing more Republicans, for example, talk about solutions to make rooftop solar more affordable and accessible, I think is an indication of change. I think the fact that stormwater, the increasing recognition in the State House that stormwater is going to be an increasing problem in our state is also an encouraging sign, because that paves the way for then enacting legislation in the General Assembly around green water, a green infrastructure.
I'll go right ahead.
I was just going to say, Matt, which I think is going to be huge to helping farmers deal with the catastrophic impacts that climate change are going to have over the decades on farming in our state.
There are obstacles, though, to getting more politicians to take these issues seriously. What are some of them?
Well, there's different dimensions to that question, Matt. Obviously, I think cost has often been the big holdup. But, you know, if we were to zero in on how we produce electricity, because obviously the power sector has been the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in this country, the trends have been remarkably positive. The fact that we've seen a 65% reduction in rooftop solar over the last decade, the fact that we've seen an even greater drop in the cost of utility scale solar. So you have situations, Matt, where in Northwest Indiana with NIPSCO, the utility there, they anticipate getting more than 65% of their electricity from utility scale renewable energy, as well as utility scale storage by the end of this decade, which is just a remarkable turn of events for a state that has historically been in the top three in terms of its dependency on coal.
Denise Abdul-Rahman is the Environmental Climate Justice Chair for the Indiana State Conference of the NAACP. Denise, there is an energy efficiency project coming to Hammond. Can you talk about it?
Sure. Yeah, we partnered with our local Hammond branch, and they identified a facility there that the Philia Steen Family Health Center that provides health services to the community. It's in the east side of Hammond. It's an area that's underinvested. And so as we look at helping to transition our communities, this investment is going to reduce their energy costs by like $980 a month, and it was $1,200. So they'll be able to provide more services to the community. In addition, their carbon footprint was 198 pounds of CO2, 198,000 pounds of CO2 emissions, and it would be reduced to 68,000 pounds. So it's equivalent to taking off 14 cars off of the highway. And so we also see this as somewhat of like an equitable model, right? Because we might come up with the technological solutions and maybe climate solutions may be inevitable, but equity is not. And so we do look forward to any of the policies that are moved, that they certainly include equitable models that also assure resilience and inclusion of communities. And so it's definitely on the ballot. We sent out that we think that folks should vote for an energy just candidate. We laid out what those are for us here in Indiana. And we do see that some of the legislators have an African-American agenda that has renewable energy and environmental justice on their agenda. We see that commendable. We see others coming up with equity resolutions. And so we see progress also in the state house. And so some promising hope for our community. So climate, environment, and equity are they are not exclusive. They must be interconnected.
How much of a challenge is it, Denise, in your experience, to get funding for projects like the one happening in Hammond?
It's not easy. We're very appreciative of the funder that did support us and support the frame around equity and inclusion. You know, when we fought against Bill House Bill 1320 several years back, it was all about how solar was not fair to communities of color. And we pushed back and said that solar was fair and that we, in fact, out of the 1,600 solar adopters of rooftop solar, that we believe that there were none that were people of color or at least African-American, and that we felt we were the emerging market. And so this particular legislation and other pieces of legislations like Senate Bill 309, you know, took away the credits and grant and grandfathering net metering here soon. So we're trying to hear at the last moment before net metering basically is retired in 2022. We're trying to make sure that our communities get to benefit because it's not been affordable. And now it's about to be, you know, basically obliterated. And those that have been more fortunate have been able are able to be grandfathered in and so forth. So the investor that our funder that's helping us to move some of our communities and to lift up how it's important to Black and Brown communities, it's greatly appreciated.
Nathaniel Stinnett is with us, and he is representing the national part of this conversation. He's executive director and founder of the Environmental Voter Project. So, Nathaniel, if we're looking at the federal government, is there something that seems to separate successful legislation about climate and environmental issues from the legislation that doesn't get through?
Yeah, it all comes down to political power. You know, a lot
it's
of
as simple
talk,
as that.
It's as simple as that. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people talk about the necessity of bipartisanship in order to get long lasting legislation done. But I actually think that's a little bit inaccurate because the truth is, you know, you can have a bipartisan agreement that lasts for 1 minute or one session or one decade or one century. What actually moves politicians is their desire to win elections. Mm-hmm. I mean, even in this hyper-partisan moment that we're living in, there is still one thing, Matt, that unites all Democrats and all Republicans, and that is, boy, do they all love winning elections. And so when you ask me what does it take to have real climate solutions, real environmental solutions, what it takes is having a significant number of political leaders feel like they've got a lead on this stuff or they're not going to be able to be a politician anymore.
When we look at the new numbers, 12% of voters putting climate at the top of their priorities list, Nathaniel, has the communication on the campaign trail reflected that?
It has, but in a somewhat inefficient way, right? Politics is not a perfectly efficient marketplace because we've got gerrymandering, we've got corporate money, we have regional differences. People, you know, there aren't as many people who care about the environment in, for instance, West Virginia as there are in Florida. There are a lot in West Virginia, but not as many as in Florida. So what all of these inefficiencies do, because we have a U.S. Senate that gives as many senators to West Virginia as Florida, and because we have gerrymandering and because we have corporate money in politics, is political leadership is a lagging indicator. But even though it lags, voter demand for environmental leadership, eventually it catches up to it for the sole reason that nothing motivates a politician more than the prospect of winning or losing an election. So we're not at this turning point yet. We certainly aren't. But if we continue to grow the number of climate first and environment first voters, not just in a few states here and there, but in every state, politicians are going to follow because otherwise they won't get to be politicians anymore. It's the simple arithmetic of how democracy works.
I want to make sure we get to this listener voicemail. This is from Russ, who has a comment on the politics behind these issues. Let's listen.
I applaud all these groups for doing what they can to help the environment. And I think as far as Indiana is concerned, it's more political because until we can get rid of gerrymandering and we can get rid of the lever that allows you to vote for one party or another exclusively, I think that the current political situation is working against all of us as far as the environment is concerned. So my recommendation is to continue what you're doing, but we all need to work on those two issues. Thank you.
Jesse Carbonda, I mean, have you seen the same?
I think that's a very fair point about how gerrymandering and also the very weak campaign finance laws in the state are huge structural impediments to making significant progress to the legislature. However, we have to I guess think on a couple of different levels, right? We've got to think in terms of how do we move conservatives in a direction so long as there is a supermajority of Republicans in the House and the Senate? How can we move them effectively? And that I think comes in so many different ways. You know, the Purdue Climate Change Research Center, for the first time to my knowledge, has briefed lawmakers in both parties about climate science. And that climate science is derived from Hoosier scientists, and it is Indiana specific. And I think that will hopefully change the thinking of lawmakers regardless of political party. I also think that as, say, evangelical churches and conservative Catholic churches begin to put rooftop solar, that's going to have some change. That's going to cause some change in the mindset of conservative lawmakers in terms of their thinking about climate solutions like solar. And then, of course, as people just see the practical reality of things changing in their communities because of extreme flooding, because of extreme heat, that's going to cause them to be compelled to carry out a policy response, largely for the point that Nathaniel made, that they're just not going to want to get the ire of their constituents. And even if they're not talking about climate change per se, they're going to be trying to advance a solution to address it.
Shannon Anderson is with us. She's Assistant Director of Earth Charter Indiana. And we got some national perspective from Nathaniel a little bit ago. But Shannon, what should people look for when they look at state policy if they're concerned about these kinds of issues? I mean, how do you know if something is worth supporting, especially if you're not an expert in the field?
Sure. I mean, I think that the most important thing that people can be doing is having conversations with their state lawmakers and their local representatives in city government or their town governments. I think that it's a daunting proposition for some people to reach out to lawmakers and try to set up that call or that meeting. But if that makes you nervous, just send a text, send an email, do something, make sure they hear from you. And I know that there are a lot more people engaged this year than there ever have been before. But really make that a priority for yourself going forward, that you communicate with your lawmakers about the things that you care about, because it is their job to come up with policy solutions and trust experts to come up with best practices for the state. And if you have ideas, by all means, share them. But the one thing I really wanted to touch upon, because Jesse did a good job kind of covering the state legislature, is that cities and mayors are actually a really powerful climate ally here in Indiana. We have kids who are leading the charge and city councils across the state. 11 cities now have passed youth-led climate resolutions to either declare their cities to be carbon neutral by a certain year or to start a commission on environmental sustainability. There's different approaches for different places, but that work is incredibly important. So if you can get involved in your local community on that type of thing, that's probably one of the most effective things you can do here. In the absence of leadership from the state, mayors are stepping up because the buck stops with them. When there's extreme flooding, when there's heat waves, their offices get, you know, filled up with, you know, notes and calls. So we host every year a climate leadership summit for mayors, staff, and other city officials. And this year, Mayor Winicky from Evansville said, you know, understands that there's a lot of politics around this issue. But he says, you know, his advice to fellow mayors was to focus on the issues, focus on the issues that affect the people that live in your communities, and you'll be doing right by them.
And do you have a few examples of how mayors and local officials, elected officials have really, really kind of changed things in some significant and surprising ways?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the good examples is the city of Goshen here in Indiana, because they've started some amazing programs like an urban tree program that's probably kind of leading the way in the state to try to improve the number of trees that are in their city, but also making commitments to clean energy and to tackling stormwater in new and innovative ways. So all of those things are really important climate adaptations and mitigative efforts. So I'm glad that Jesse touched upon Purdue Climate Change Research as well, Research Center, because they are providing really amazing impact assessment reports for areas around the state that cities can look to say, what can we expect to see? And that we also partner a lot with IU's Environmental Resilience Institute, and they have an amazing Hoosier Life Survey. So if people want to find out what their fellow Hoosiers think about climate and climate action, that's full of lots of information too.
I'd like to thank all of our, we're going to have to leave it at that. I'm sorry, Shannon Anderson, Assistant Director of Earth Charter Indiana. I want to thank everybody for joining us today. Jesse Carbonda, Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Denise Abdul-Rahman, Environmental Climate Justice Chair for the Indiana State Conference of the NAACP. And Nathaniel Stinnett, Executive Director and Founder of the Environmental Voter Project. Great show today. Thanks for listening. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In.